Well, let's find our way back to the book of Daniel. We've had a couple of weeks off here as we had our fifth Wednesday home studies last weekend, or last Wednesday. I trust you were all blessed. Certainly the teachers, they speak of how much, how blessed they were. We do that to basically counteract this. Church is getting bigger. It's getting harder and harder to fit like in small spaces like the coffee house. And so for the summer, at least we'll be up here. We'll see what God will do. I mean, if we stay continuing to grow, well, there's no going back. we will try to make sure that there is plenty of small group ministries in which you will be able to participate in to keep that fellowship dynamic going on. If you missed last week, we every month it has five Wednesdays in it. On the fifth Wednesday, we don't meet here. We go off to home studies at various locations. This is probably the only year we're going to be able to do six, too, because they're crowded already. So next year, there'll probably be more than six. So that'll only be growing, too. When is the next fifth Wednesday month? Wow. So fast, huh? Okay. And so that I hope you're blessed. If you're did not go last week and you go, I don't know nothing about this, and you want to be a part of this, all you got to do is between now and that Wednesday, you need to make sure you call the office so we can put you in the right place, okay? Because we're trying to distribute equally. It has nothing to do with anything other than keeping the trying to keep equal numbers, all right? So we're not 40 of us stuffed into Benita's living room, wherever she is. So she lives in a garage. No, I'm like, no, she has a very nice home. I was there. So, anybody, as long as we could find her place. I understand some of you sellouts or harnesses couldn't find the house. You know, they shouldn't let you drive if you don't know your way around. Huh? Apparently that wasn't on the Pickle Queen test. Directions. They didn't give her that. So that's all right. As soon as you get married, then you have a guy that'll be able to find your way around for you. That's okay. All right. Chapter 11, the book of Daniel. Chapter 11. Now again, if you were you haven't been with us as we go through the book of Daniel. Book of Daniel is a very prophetic book. Some certainly, arguably, will tell you that it is the most prophetic book concerning the last days events of the Antichrist, the seven-year period, the tribulation, all those great events of which they make movies and publish books in on today. And as I really drove home the point when we began this book, as I often do when we deal with prophetic books. I think it's very critical that as we go through this book, go through prophetic books in general, that we remember that the point of this is not to be all exciting and titillating like, you know, some sort of, you know, movie. This isn't King Kong, you know, with all special sci-fi effects. This is real life. This is something that is going to be the heartbreak of heartbreaks. You need to realize that in these events, millions of people will die. Millions of people will die to go into eternity apart from God. That's what makes the earnestness of what we're being told that much more pertinent. We need to take hold of this information and to apply it into our ministry and to apply it into our lives. We that are Christians are called to the body of Christ and called to ministry. This should be a motivator. So let's keep our minds on the right aspect of this prophecy, and that is that we would apply it to our lives, that we would use it now to further the ministry, not just to be some sort of horror movie in which we'll all see the credits roll and we go back home to our lives. So chapter 11, where we pick up, if you recall, in chapter 10, Daniel now is having a vision experience, if you can put it in those terms, with either an angelic being or a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ. Pre-incarnate, meaning prior to Matthew, prior to Jesus being born in a manger. Jesus didn't suddenly appear in a scene. He existed all the way back into Genesis, waiting for his day, waiting for the fulfillment of the cross, the fulfillment of the promises of God to take the place for mankind. And he appeared pre-incarnate several places in Scripture, and this is believed to be one of those. So either this is, you know, this is a heavenly being in either, no matter how you look at it. So Daniel now is in the presence of a heavenly being, and we begin in those terms, beginning verse 1 of chapter 11. And it says in quotes, "Also in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him." Now Darius the Mede, if you recall, this is in the Persian, then Babylonian, and then Persian conquering empires. And what this angelic being is saying to Daniel is that even those pagan kings were there by the hand of God. Now that's sometimes hard for us to kind of absorb, that some of even the things that are negative in this world may still be under at least the control of God. Maybe he didn't design it per se, but he let it occur, and that the kingdom will ultimately be furthered because of that. Again, that's hard for us to believe sometimes. We look at the world and say, you know, I don't see how this is going to give God glory. Well, maybe it doesn't now, but it will ultimately. Each one of us is given a choice. Each one of us has an opportunity to walk with God or not. And each one of us will stand before the Lord, and we all will have to, explain ourselves, if you will. We've all been given the opportunity to follow him or not. It's not like we can get there and go, oh, God, I'm so surprised. We're all fully aware. So this being, again, that has come to Daniel here, confesses his involvement in both the life and the ministry of Daniel for quite some time, all the way back. I mean, the visions for Daniel have been coming right from his youth. This being was moving to affect the political realm, to undertake some spiritual results in the things that were going on in this world. That is for the spiritual world to deal with, not us. Going on to verse 2, it says, "And now I will tell you the truth. Behold." Now this is that spiritual being, again, pre-incarnate Christ or an angelic being, sharing prophetic vision with Daniel. "And now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia. The fourth shall be far richer than them all. By his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. Then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will." Now, as we go through the first half, anyway, of chapter 11, it is rather historic in nature. You could look at this and just think, well, this is just a history lesson. But I would really encourage you to realize that there is a point God is sharing this with us. We have all the way through the prophetic books that we've shared with so far, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Daniel. We have shared the aspect that God oftentimes does a near fulfillment of prophecy and a long or far fulfillment. Sometimes there's even a middle. Why does he do that? So that we might clearly understand the ways of God, his M.O., how he operates. And so as we go through this, yes, there is a historic aspect, but I want you to look at how God's dealing with mankind and how he interacts, because this is the dynamic of how he is going to deal with mankind in the end. You know, oftentimes we want to get down and try to read between the lines. We want to scrutinize the Greek and the Hebrew and the Aramaic and, ooh, well, this verse means this and this means way back. You know, I think we'd be better off to just read this text and go, well, you know, I'm catching a concept here of God dealing with man in this way. That is how God will deal with us in those last days, because he is the same yesterday, today, and forever. So if you want to look into prophecy, that's your aspect, that's your avenue. And in doing so, in the correct manner of biblical interpretation, you will come to know the ways of God. And that is not just applied just in the grand scale, the worldwide humanity prophecy kind of realm, but in an individual basis. Because ultimately, that's where the buck stops, where the rubber meets the road, you and Jesus. How he deals with mankind in that realm. So these events here, that as this angelic being begins to prophesy here, I want you to notice, and we'll comment on this all the way along, that he gives this prophecy in absolute stark detail. Four more kings, just as it says here, did indeed rule in Persia. And the fourth, just like clockwork here, moved, as prophesied, to antagonize the Greeks. He was somewhat successful, but in the end he was not ultimately successful. He was beaten back. Now the mighty king, which shall go up against Persia here, we know, already read prophecy concerning it, was Alexander the Great. And history will give you the details of his conquests and his travels more than Scripture here. Again, because Scripture is trying to stay in the spiritual realm as much as possible. Going on, verse 4. And when he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up. This is speaking of Alexander the Great. When he is risen, his kingdom shall be broken up, divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not among his posterity, nor according to his dominion which he ruled. For his kingdom shall be uprooted, even for others besides these. And as we've already commented in the past, just as prophesied here, history tells us that when Alexander did die, his kingdom did not go to a son, as was often the case in those days. It was divided up amongst his four top generals. They split up his conquest. Alexander the Great's conquest, that was the peak. From there, it split up. So here in Scripture, long before Alexander the Great existed, God was calling the shots. Exactly, precisely. Verse 5, also the king of the south shall become strong, as well as one of his princes, and he shall gain power over him and have dominion. His dominion shall be great dominion. Again, true to prophecy, one of these four kings, the king of the south, or Egypt here, and his name was, I don't know how to pronounce it, Ptolemy, 323-285 BC. One of his princes refers to Seleucus Nicator, 311-280 BC. Names that probably don't mean anything to you, other than the fact that this prophecy was did occur, just as laid out here. Now, this king that he speaks of here was, just like prophecy says, was very successful in his conquest, and he moved, and he kind of ended up being the top man amongst these four, and he began what was a long succession of successful Greek rulers. The last of these successful Greek rulers was Cleopatra. So again, history proving to be absolutely prophetic fulfilling here. Verse 6, and at the end of some years, they shall join forces. For the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the power of her authority, and neither he nor his authority shall stand. But she shall be given up with those who brought her, and with him who begot her, and with him who strengthened her in those times. But from a branch of her roots, one shall arise in his place, who shall come with an army, enter the fortress of the king of the north, and deal with them and prevail. And he shall also carry their gods captive to Egypt, with their princes, their precious articles of silver and gold, and it shall continue more years than the king of the north. Also the king of the north shall come to the kingdom of the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. So, there was the king of the north. This was Seleucus the First, and he started this whole dynasty of kings that began what was basically, and again, we don't need to get into this in great detail, but began what was kind of a tit-for-tat battle that went on for roughly 200 years. One of these kings, Antiochus the Second, married the daughter of the southern king, and it was giving up the daughter in an attempt to try to make some sort of peace. In this period of time, covered in these passages, there was in the political realm here this warfare, this fighting, this making up, fighting, making up. It lasted for basically 200 years. It was very much like the end time scripture when it talks about that there will be wars and rumors of wars. I share that with you because I want you to understand that there's a mirror events going on here. What we see going on here is going to happen again in a greater fulfillment, but it's going to happen again. So for hundreds of years, there was this back and forth. Wars, rumors of wars, peace. They used to be my enemy, now they're our friend. I mean, isn't it amazing how we're like, we're buds with all the old Soviet Union? Isn't that crazy? I mean, I grew up and Russia was the big, bad, terrible people, you know. I mean, you know, we're going to blow them off the face of the earth. Now we go over and, you know, we hang out with them. And that's often the people that we've shared, the people that have been our allies in the past. We have fought skirmishes and wars that they were shooting at us with the weapons we gave them. Those were American weapons because they used to be our friends. We trained them how to use them so they could shoot at us. That's what's going on here. Certainly in a more rudimentary fashion and in older terms, but the events that are going on here is just the same. At one point here, as it shares, this bride for peace had a brother. This is the branch of her roots, verse 7. This brother, and this is all historical, he came out of Egypt and he went up and he stomped the king of the north and he took all of his stuff. And then the king of the north came down to retaliate. You know, it's like a bunch of kids. You took my stuff and I'm coming down to get you. He came down to get his stuff, but the king of the south whooped him again and he went back home without any of his stuff. And that's kind of what was going on here. Again, you can look all the stuff up in secular history, and this chapter is playing absolutely historically accurate. Okay? Verse 10. However, his son shall stir up strife and assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overwhelm and pass through, and he shall return to his fortress and stir up strife. And the king of the south shall be moved with rage and go out with fight with him, and the king of the north, who shall muster a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into the hand of the enemy. When he has taken away the multitude, his heart will be lifted up. He will cast down tens of thousands, but he will not prevail. For the king of the north will return, muster a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come at the end of some years with a great army and much equipment. Now in those times, many shall rise up against the king of the south. Also violent men of your people shall exalt themselves in fulfillment of the vision, for they shall fall. So the king of the north shall come in, build a siege mound, take a fortified city, and the forces of the south shall not withstand him. Even his choice troops shall have no strength to resist. But he who comes against him shall do according to his own will, and no one shall stand against him. He shall stand in the glorious land with destruction in his power. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women to destroy it, but she shall not stand with him or be for him. And this he shall turn his face to the coastlands, and shall take many, but a ruler shall bring the reproach against them to an end, and with the reproach removed he shall turn back on him. Then he shall turn his face toward the fortress of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. There shall rise in his place one who imposes taxes on the glorious kingdom, but within a few days he shall be destroyed, but not in anger or battle. Now, I read straight through that because certainly this is something that I'm not going to go into excruciating detail in a study. If you're a big history buff, I encourage you to pick up a good commentary and read through it. I mean, Wolvard is a good one that goes through it. I can suggest some other ones if you see me after the service, if you're interested in this. But you know, it can start to get a little tedious if we don't just get to the point. And the point here is that there's this seesaw of politics and warfare that was going on. These were going to follow the days of Daniel. Now, Daniel now is having this prophecy, and now we're reaching way beyond his lifetime. We're reaching way out into the future, and soon, whether he realizes it and understands it totally, he's going to reach even beyond our future here as we sit here tonight. Now, again, these kings are going to battle back and forth. No one is ever going to find any lasting peace. No one is ever going to find any overwhelming victory. Sound like the world today, doesn't it? I mean, one has to seriously consider that tit-for-tat, back-and-forth kind of reality that was going on then, this is what we are in today. And certainly, as we look into the face of prophecy and the impending Antichrist, the seventh week, you know, the whole tribulation period,
as it seems it is right around the corner, it would then naturally speak that we are right now in this period of time. This is it. This is the time of wars and rumors of wars. And there's never any lasting peace. It's just constant, back and forth, back and forth. The passing of these last kings here, as I read in this passage, is going to pave the way now for the one player in which we are specifically interested in tonight, and that is the rising of the great Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, this is the player. This is the player because he is, in effect, the embodiment or the picture of the Antichrist that is yet coming in our day. So we need to pay close attention to the activities of this Antiochus Epiphanes, because this and he will tell you a lot of how things are going to be when the Antichrist takes power. Let's go on and read about it. Verse 21. And in his place shall arise a vile person to whom they will not give the honor of royalty. But he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. In other words, he didn't come in from the family. He wasn't the son of a king. He wasn't royalty. He was the surprise contender, the dark horse. All right? Verse 22, with the force of a flood, they shall be swept away from before him and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant. And after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully. And he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people. In other words, after an agreement is made with this guy, he's going to stick it to him. Sound familiar, doesn't it? Verse 24, and he shall enter peaceably, even into the richest places of the province, and he shall do what his fathers have done. He shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, the spoil, the riches. He shall devise his plans against the strongholds, but only for a time. He shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army. But he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him. Yes, those who eat of the portion of his delicacy shall destroy him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. Now again, back to verse 21. What we have here is the opening of the chapter of history, which introduces the reign of this Antiochus Epiphanes. Again, he is the picture. In the Bible interpretation, we call it a type, a biblical type of the coming Antichrist. Why again did God do this? He did this so we might see clearly and understand what he's going to do, how God interacts. If we can bank upon the concept that God is the same yesterday, today, and forever, and we can look at how God dealt with mankind in the past and realize that's how he's going to deal with us today and in the future. And we can look and even see how he dealt with us individually. What kind of things did he, you know, give people a spanking for? That hasn't changed. He's going to come give you a whooping for that now. What kind of things did he, and in what situations did he apply grace? That's a situations that he's going to apply grace now. He wants us to know him, but his answers are here in the Word of God. And you have to read the Word of God, and you need to know who God was back then to know who God is now. And, you know, start in Genesis. I'm not saying you need to read through Leviticus and Numbers. That's kind of scary. It's not exactly light reading. You know, go to Genesis and then like jump to Joshua. All right, read Joshua. That's great. Read Job. That's scary, isn't it? Read Psalms. You know, it's important for us to come to know who God is so we know who God is today with us. Now, this text describes this guy as vile. Now, how's that for a, you know, tombstone record? Vile. Big bold letters there. The original language renders the word vile as disdained, to scorn, to despise, to hold in contempt, to be despicable and worthless. That's nice, isn't it? Antiochus, apparently, according to the text, with some stealth and guile here, kind of slipped into the political realm. See, I think oftentimes we're looking for the Antichrist and we're seeing guys, you know, rise on the whole scene, you know. I remember when George Stephanopoulos, for those of you who are in the political realm, when he came up, I mean, you know, I always read, oh, you know, this guy could be the Antichrist. You know, because, I mean, he was suave, he was good looking, you know. He all of a sudden just came out of nowhere, he had lots of power. Anybody seen George lately? Yeah, no. You know, so see, we need to quit doing that because this guy's going to come out of nowhere, right? And when he does, he's going to be doing it again with a lot of guile, very, very, you know, 007 kind of thing going on here, all right? So he's going to come in and he's going to work in a political realm. This says that he signed a peace agreement with Egypt only to gain then free entrance into the Egyptian territory to conquer and pillage. Now, does that mean the Antichrist is going to sign a peace agreement with Egypt? Well, I don't know. Certainly we can see that that's very plausible that he could be signing a peace agreement with someone. I mean, at that point, Egypt was, you know, an enemy. Who's Israel's enemy now? You bet. Just across the border. The Arab nations that they've been fighting for years. Now it's the Hamas, and they had enough guile to elect those guys into the controlling power. And then they wonder why we won't come play with them, you know. I don't know, maybe it's because you keep blowing us up, you know. It's a small little issue there. So there is a lot of understanding that the Antichrist will create a short period of peace. I would be very suspicious of anybody who managed to pull that off. Just last week, after all the land's been given over to them, after all that has happened, one of the chief clerics across the border said, look, we're not going to ever have any peace as long as Israel's in are occupying our land. What do you want? Well, they want Jerusalem. They want it all. They want them gone off the face of the earth. And now they're going to build a big wall there. But see, there's not going to be any peace, not true peace in Palestine until Jesus is sitting upon the throne. So, Antiochus makes this little deal with Egypt, but it's just a ruse so that he can go in and steal their stuff. And it was a lot of the Egyptian rulers that kind of confided with him to bring down Egypt. You need to realize Antiochus was quite a salesman. This guy could convince anybody. I mean, you read this, and he just always seemed to get everybody to go against everybody else. You know, and when I was reading about this, and you know, don't quote me on this because you know I'm freelancing here, but there was the story of that there was a guy. I think his name was Jason. You know, I don't trust any guy named Jason. His name was actually Jason, and he decided he wanted to be the high priest. So he paid off Antiochus to get the real high priest thrown out, so he could be high priest. And so Antiochus went for this. He took his money, threw out the guy, made him high priest. Then another guy promptly came along and said he wanted to be high priest, and he bribed him to throw Jason out and put him in high priest. Antiochus took his money, threw out Jason, and put him into place. The original guy, way back at the beginning, got all upset about it, so he just had him killed. This is the way Antiochus Epiphanes played. Yeah, take your money. So in order to gain friends and loyalty here, he was always kind of working the system. And you notice from the text here, when he went into Egypt, took their stuff, what did he do? Well, he gave it to all the common people, made friends. I mean, he was, all of a sudden, he was, you know, Robin Hood or something. I'm a great guy. Steal from the rich, give to the poor. It was all a plot. Let's go on. Verse 27. Both these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table. This is the guy from Egypt and the guy from Israel, Antiochus, which may be the Antichrist and, you know, the head of Hamas today, who knows. But definitely in those times, both of these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil. They shall speak lies at the same table, but it shall not prosper, for at the end will stand for the end will still be at the appointed time. In other words, they're not going to change anything. I think that's important. See, don't get any crazy ideas. I'm going to strap some, you know, dynamite on me, and I'm going to, you know, go into the Temple Mount. I'm going to blow up the Islamic shrine there so we can rebuild the temple, and we'll you know, push their kingdom age. You're not going to change anything. You see, the history of man, it's written in stone. Ours is merely to play our part in this. We're not going to change history. I mean, somewhere, God's got it all written. He knows exactly how He's going to finish all of this. It's not going to be any surprise. He's not like, you know, shooting from the hip and just kind of, oh, hey, I could do this. No, He knows exactly what He's doing. It's all laid out. In fact, the Bible speaks in the terms of with God, it's already happened. That's how sure it is. So there were attempts between these two guys, Antiochus Epiphanes and the ruler of Egypt. There were attempts at mutual peace here. But you know what? You can't make peace with evil. I mean, it's just not going to happen. So Antiochus and Ptolemy of Egypt, they made, again, overtures of peace, but in the end, they were just kind of clandestinely and simultaneously, I might add, plotting uprising and war against each other. Oh, that sounds like modern society, doesn't it? We all sit at the table and, you know, pretend to make peace while our spies are infiltrating the country. Sort of like, you know, Iran right now. You know, we're talking peace while I'm shooting all these missiles off, the testings they've had over the past couple weeks to show you how tough they are. You mess with us. We're not Iraq. Talking out of both sides of their mouth. Verse 28. While returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the Holy Covenant, so he shall do damage and return to his own land. So Antiochus now, when he returned home, frustrated, things weren't going the way he wanted it to go, and so he took out his hostility upon God's people. Remember, he is an occupying ruler even over Israel at this point. So he's going to come home and he's going to whoop up on these guys, all right? Now, he'd already begun to kind of turn on Israel. As he began to turn and put the pressure on Israel, which was the occupying nation that was his primary interest, as he began to turn the screws upon him here, there began to be a great separation between the people. Now that's important because that's exactly what's going to happen with the Antichrist. As the Antichrist comes on the political realm, there's going to be in Israel many people who are going to see that or believe that he's the Messiah. Because you see, he will fit the messianic ideal far more than Jesus. I mean, the Jews don't want Jesus. Jesus was a poor carpenter's son. I mean, he didn't have any money. He didn't have any clout. He was not, you know, he was not from royal family, or at least they knew about. And you know, he was just some guy's kid, carpenter's kid from Nazareth. And he went around and he did good and he healed people. They were looking for somebody to come up and whoop up on Rome. See, they were occupied by Rome at the time. They were looking for a military guy. Well, the Antichrist, he'll be a military guy. Well, they wanted someone who had supernatural power. The Antichrist, he'll have supernatural power. They're looking for someone who will have some political clout. He was the man, the Antichrist. He'll be the man. And so you have to understand, Israel will see the Antichrist as the Messiah. I told you guys when we've been going through this that it wasn't long back in the newspaper they quoted one of the top Israeli generals who made the statement that the man who will bring peace to Israel, we will follow him even if he's the devil himself. There you go. Good, because he will be the devil himself. But he accurately reflected the heart of Israel. You understand, they're tired, man. I mean, it's just been unrelenting. They haven't had a minute's peace. You know, we have 9/11 go on. They blow up a building, And we are like just crumble in this country. We just, you know, oh, nerves are shot. We're all freaked out. We all go to church for like 2 months and we're all, oh no, we're going to die. We're going to die. And we all, you know, get our generators and our canned goods and everything. Don't you understand? Some countries live with this every single day. Israel's one of them. How long has this been going on in Northern Ireland? And there's brief, you know, respite once in a while, and then they start going back over it. And what do you know about it? Catholics and Protestants. That's all I know about it. But they're up there blowing each other up. Sudan. What's it been, 25 years? Millions dead. Raped, hacked to death. Terrible deaths. It's just every day. I mean, this is what the world is like out there. But we live in the American bubble. That's why I appreciate, you know, Street Level. In the new edition of Word on the Street, did a whole story kind of with that dynamic. Real nice job, too. Even got quotes from Hanuk, Vadim and Jari pastor. That was kind of a neat thing to do. So, I mean, tribal India of what life is like. And you start to realize, wow, we do kind of live in this little glass house, you know. Really a house of mirrors, because all we see is us. This is the world that's going to be rising upon with the Antichrist. Now, one more comment. As this division starts to happen, and it happened here, half followed Antiochus. They were willing to abandon their traditional faith, and they're going with this man. The other half, all of a sudden, there is an awakening that goes on in them. They're like, hey, this guy's bad. This guy's trying to take us. So now there is a division. That is what is going to happen in Israel. Half are going to say, this man's the Messiah, we're with him. The other half are not going to go down to their house to get their coat. They're going to flee. And it is happening even in an effect within the church. It's going to happen. There are many people that are going to hold this guy up as being, you know, a political redeemer. He's like the second coming of Christ. Oh, this guy's great, you know. Let's all just give him praise and worship. The other half of the American church is going to go, oh, wait a minute, man. We've been asleep in our pews. We need to get up and do something. This is the end. So there's always the sheep and the goats, the division. And it was happening even then. Going on, verse 29. And at the appointed time, he shall return and go toward the south, but he shall not be like the former or the latter. So in other words, as he went down and tried to take Egypt, okay, he came back home again. Now he's going to go back again. For the ships from Cyprus, otherwise known as Greece, shall come against him, therefore he shall be grieved. And he'll return in rage against the Holy Covenant and do damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. And forces shall be mustered by him. And they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. They shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. Now, I cannot tell you whether Daniel really understood at this point what was going on. I don't know if that was required. The angel was using him as a conduit. He spoke to him. Maybe he got kind of part of this, but he put it all down. We understand it a little bit more. Certainly, as the years go by, and we get a little bit closer and a little bit closer, we'll understand it even more. But Antiochus here, what he did is he already went down and he kind of dug into Egypt a little bit there. Apparently, he liked that Egyptian stuff. He thought, you know, I'm going to go down there, I'm going to get more stuff. In fact, I'm going to go down there, and I'm going to take Egypt totally. So he went down there with hopes of a total conquest. But this time, as he neared his goal, it was not Egypt who met him. It was Greece who met him. It was the army of Alexander the Great. So it was Rome, and allegiance to Egypt at this point that turned him back. Now Antiochus is upset. I mean, he thought he was the man. You know, he had his army, and all of a sudden now he's looking bad. So he comes home. He's upset. So he's been beaten back. So what's he do? He comes home. He takes out his frustration in a greater degree upon God's people. This time he comes in and he loots the temple. He stops the daily sacrifices for sin. And in the temple is placed the, quote, abomination of desolation. What does that mean totally? Well, best guess here. History tells us that the abomination of desolation in this context was the statue of the Greek god Zeus, who was placed there in the temple, and a pig then was slaughtered on the altar. Now, if you know anything about Judaism, I mean, there isn't any more of a foul animal, I think, than pigs, pork. Jews don't eat pork. That's fine. Leaves more for me. Because I believe God, I mean, he made bacon. Smoked. Mm-mm. Okay, so this is to a Jew, though, unclean animal, all right? And so they sacrificed this pig to Zeus on the altar, rendering it effectively unclean. This happened. They even know. December 16th, 168 BC. It's that historically accurate. Verse 32. Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. And those of the people who understand shall instruct many. Yet for many days they shall fall by the sword and flame, by captivity and plundering. Now this is great because, again, long before the events transpired here, Daniel's receiving this prophecy. At this point in history, a man by the name of Mattathias and his five sons rose up to rebel against Antiochus Epiphanes. They killed many of the king's men. Then they fled to the hills to operate a very successful and quite famous guerrilla campaign of warfare against Antiochus for the next 3 years. This was the beginning of the famed Maccabean Revolt. And anyone who's a Jew certainly knows about the Maccabean Revolt. And so now there was this newfound clarity. All of a sudden there was this, oh no, what's going on here? This is not a good man. We thought he was a good guy. He sacrificed a pig on the altar. Obviously this guy's bad. So now they're going to fight against him in a guerrilla warfare. Now, you never want to fight a people on their home turf. Anyone who knows anything about warfare knows that. We found out the hard way in Vietnam, Korea. We're certainly finding that out even in Iraq, Afghanistan. Now, if this battles that we're fighting around the world was going on here, and I'm not wishing that it did, but it certainly would be a different story, wouldn't it? Mostly because we in Dunn County are absolutely armed to the teeth. Okay? I mean, we all have high-powered rifles with scopes, and we're good. Okay? We're good. We won't be wearing any blaze orange those days, will we? I mean, it'd be a totally different story. Why? Because this is our land. And here we'd fight to the death, wouldn't we? And that's the same mentality when you're fighting people on their own turf. Now, all of a sudden, Mattathias, you know, he's got this very successful guerrilla warfare going. The exploits of these guys is very, very famous. I mean, you can get books just on what these guys did. And their warfare was extraordinary in what they did. So he goes on here to say that those who understood, in other words, those who understood the truth of what was happening here, those who understood the truth, they went on to wage war against Antiochus and also to teach those who didn't know. Again, sounding very much like the last 3.5 years of the tribulation period, in which there will be a great awakening amongst the Jewish people. Oh no, this isn't our Messiah. This is the Antichrist that the Christian church has been telling us about. So there'll be those who will wage war. Now, many Jewish people, as it says in verse 33, died. Again, they were very brave. Their exploits are very famous. Brilliance, I mean, incredible tenacity. They just kept fighting. All right? Verse 34. Going on that same line of thinking. Now, when they fall, okay, the Maccabeans, they shall be aided with a little help. Excuse me, when they fall is when the Maccabeans or overthrowing Antiochus, excuse me. When they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue. And some of those who understanding shall fall to refine them, purify them, make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. So now when this Maccabean revolt begins to happen here, it began to get some headway. And this is prophecy at this point, but this is what happened. He's saying as it gets a little bit of headway here, it becomes a popular revolt, and a popular revolt begins to now attract those hanger-ons. Those who have less conviction than the original fighters, but they want to be with the winning side, right? So they kind of sit back and they wait till, you know, the tide starts to turn towards the Maccabeans. Oh, well, we're going to go with the Maccabeans. That's what was occurring here. So some of these started to join up, and it didn't really matter what they believed in. And what they believed in was still kind of that pagan, kind of Grecian ideal. But they didn't want to be part of the losing side, so they began to saddle up with the Maccabeans. So in the end, and history bore this out, in the end, many of the committed and zealous fighters of the Maccabeans, they executed a lot of these wannabes, their own people. Civil war. They killed a lot of their own people in order to preserve the integrity and the purity of the group as well as the battle. That's exactly what happened. And it's in truth, guys, like any great work of God, anytime God's work begins to be poured out, there's always going to be those who are going to come along and want to ride on the coattails of those who are committed, those who are sold out. They want to ride it to power. They want to ride it to position. They want to ride it to safety. Let me give you a perfect example. Now, most of you aren't old enough to remember these things, and I just came in on the tail end of it. But during the Jesus revolution of the late 60s, early 70s, when all of a sudden Jesus was, you know, hip, back when that logo was actually new, okay? And a lot of people, that Jesus became cool. I mean, it was rising amongst the hippie population, and all of a sudden Jesus was respectable and cool and groovy, you know? One way for Jesus, man. Honk if you love Jesus. All that kind of stuff. Well, what happened was, because of that, the movement got watered down. There was a lot of people. I mean, have you ever run into anybody to say, you know, and certainly I have, they go, oh, you're a Calvary Chapel pastor? Yeah, I used to go to Calvary Chapel. Yeah, I got saved and baptized back in the old tent days, back with Chuck, back in California. Really, what are you doing now? Oh, nothing. Going to church now? Oh, no. I had one guy that got, you know, I know that he got saved in the Calvary movement, and, you know, he's all hip about Chuck and baptized and all Jesus people and ooh, Holy Spirit and stuff. And now, you know, he's running around he's a monk. Episcopal, you know, kind of, I don't know, he's got like 8 different directions he's going, but he likes to wear the robes around and candles and incense. And could you get any farther then from Chuck in the tent days, where it's all hippies and barefoot, you know, and we're just, you know, all singing and, you know, with a guitar, and we're on this bandwagon when it's hip, I'm on this bandwagon when it's hip. It still goes on today. It was going on here. So there was what we would call the culling of the herd. And it also had a secondary effect, and it's recorded here, and that is that while it purified the revolt, it also purified the Jewish nation as a whole. It got rid of a lot of that watering down. The compromisers had fallen now. The faithful were still standing. They were successful against an unbelieving enemy. The cancerous leeches had been tossed out. Now, as we start verse 36 here, am I doing time? Let me read you something. This comes out of Woolford's commentary, because he said it so beautifully. Quote, "The amazingly detailed prophecies of the first 35 verses of this chapter, containing as they do approximately, ready for this, 135 prophetic statements in the past 35 verses. They are all now fulfilled. That constitutes an impressive introduction to the events that are yet future, beginning in verse 36. The fact is that there is no supported evidence which can contradict any statement made in the previous 35 verses. In other words, they are absolutely historically accurate. From the divine viewpoint, the accuracy of this prophetic word is supporting evidence that the prophecy that is yet unfulfilled, verses 36 on, will have the same precise fulfillment. Pretty cool, huh? In other words, God's going, you know, listen, before I, you know, give you this over here, I'm going to show you just how accurate I can be over here. Now I'm 100% accurate? Okay, now I'm going to tell you what else is going to happen. Do you have any reason tonight to believe that if he just fulfilled in the past 35 verses alone in this chapter, in this book of the Bible, and this is scratching the surface, guys, 135 prophecies that historically accurately came true, I'd put my money on the next few verses. Verse 36. Then the king, which no longer is a talking Antiochus, and you'll soon discover why, and the king shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god. He shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished, for what has been determined shall be done. He shall regard neither the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women. That's an interesting one. Nor regard any god, for he shall exalt himself above them all. But in their place he shall honor a god of fortresses, and a god which his fathers did not know, he shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and pleasant things. Thus he shall act against the strongest fortresses with a foreign god, which he shall acknowledge and advance its glory, and he shall cause him to rule over many and divide the land for gain. Okay. Verse 35, as we ended there, speaks of a time of the end, and that is a period that is yet to come to pass. Once again, even the most liberal commentator admits that the following verses, 36 on, have no literal fulfillment any place in history. So we can only assume that it is yet to come. We can gather these verses are future, when the Antichrist is going to take power. Now, since we know and have already discussed that the 69 weeks of Daniel's vision, and if you haven't been here and you don't know what I'm talking about, I think all these services are taped. You can go back and listen to all of Daniel. You can figure it out. The 69 weeks of Daniel's vision has already occurred. So now we are forced to understand that everything from this point forward is going to occur in that final week, quote unquote, that last and faithful 7-year period of history, which is going to bring to close the world as we know it. This predicted king will have the power to do as he pleases, and apparently he will, one, not be subject to higher human authority. Two, he will exalt himself higher than any other god, implying that he will demand worship himself. Three, he will go against the true God, fight openly against him. Four, and he will prosper for a time until God comes to deal with it in the end. He will not acknowledge Jehovah God, and according to the text here, he apparently will not have any interest in women. He shall follow a false idol, one that, according to the text, we are to gather is an idol of military and earthly strength. Now, beyond that, I don't know what this god, small g, literally is, but we can read here in 39 that just like Antiochus, the Antichrist is going to woo the world through a web of bribery and payoffs. It's all about money, right? Always is. Verse 40. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships. And he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. He shall also enter the glorious land, capital G, capital L, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape from his hand. Who will escape? Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. So now, as the end here approaches, war through this entire region is going to explode. Guys, we're not going to get a quiet time in Palestine. It's not going to happen. And certainly if it did, it will be short-lived. The Antichrist will apparently according to this text, once he has achieved power, will be attacked simultaneously from the north and from the south by two different nations, and the identity of these two nations is unknown. Why is it unknown? Because we're not supposed to know. That doesn't mean, you know, we were kind of toying with you here so you can try to guess and extrapolate. I mean, he said who was going to get away. He said Edom, Moab, and Ammon. I mean, so he was clear there. If he wanted us to know who this north and south country is, he'd tell us. Okay, now, Edom, Moab, and Ammon are going to get past this warfare. Who is Edom, Moab, and Ammon? The country of Jordan today encompasses all of that. Now, again, you have to be kind of into politics to realize that Jordan has had a way of kind of keeping their head down through all of this. I mean, they're Arab, but they're just not coming out clearly who they're standing with. It's like, we're just kind of us over here. And so they're somewhat Western. They've even allowed the West sometimes to land there in military exercises and stuff like that. But you look into Scripture. What's the history of these people? The history of these people is that they always played Israel's friend and then stuck them in a knife when they had their back turned. Again and again and again, people go, oh yeah, you know, Moab, they're our friend. In goes the knife. Over and over and over again. So what can we ascertain is going to happen here? Jordan's going to be, you know, at peace with Israel until push comes to shove. Listen, when it comes down to that, no Arab nation is going to go against the Arab tide, the Muslim tide. Probably not fair to say Arab. I think a lot of people would say, wait a minute, I'm Arab, and I'm not doing that. Excuse me, Muslim tide. Now, again, some people have hypothesized that the northern army here is going to be one of the Soviet nations. All conjecture, absolutely pure conjecture. Because there's nothing here that would even give us an idea of just how far north they're talking about. 20 miles? 2,000 miles? Nobody knows. We're not supposed to know. Verse 42. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. Also, the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. Oh, we're still naming names. So now, from his base in Israel, he's going to move against these other nations, and he's going to be quite successful. He's going to conquer many of them. And Egypt is named as one of those countries here. And a couple other nations here, Libya and Ethiopia. They're either going to be conquered, or they're going to join up with him. They're going to align himself with him, because it describes in the language here as in terms that they are his servants. Well, Libya, gee, that'd be a surprise, wouldn't it? Because they're a friendly bunch. You know, all the way back to Gaddafi and all the rest. They haven't been involved too much in political strife, have they? So the players are laid out here, as much as we are to know. Verse 44. But news from the east and the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go out with great fury to destroy, and here it is, and annihilate. That's pretty serious language. Annihilate many. And he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. So the location described as his home base here can be no place other than Jerusalem, located between the Dead Sea and the Mediterranean Sea. And it's going to be there, in Israel, that the closing chapters of this world are going to take place. Now next week, God willing, we'll finish this book as it lays out the last of the chapters of the book of Daniel. Again, I close tonight with a reminder. Please, do not allow this to become an issue of trivia. That's what the world's dealing with this Antichrist stuff. This is prophecy. This is going to happen. And millions of people are going to die. And we need to choose how we're going to play this out. It's not meant to scare us. It's meant to motivate us. Is there someone you love? Are they a believer? Get after it. Is there something you need to do? A calling upon God, by God upon your life? You need to do it. You better get after it. Time is short. And nobody is ever guaranteed another day anyway. Time is short for us individually, certainly as us in humanity. I know it's hard to imagine. We live out our lives here in Dunn County, Wisconsin, and y'all feel so very safe, you know. We're kind of isolated. I mean, for heaven's sakes, there's cornfields out there, you know. Not yet, but there will be. You know, we go to pancake dinners here, you know, and eat lutefisk. Not me, but some people do. And you know, we deer hunt and we watch football and, you know, and root Green Bay on and all. So we kind of live this idyllic American lifestyle. And we have the idea that this world as we live is just going to keep on going like this. And it's the greatest, greatest masterpiece ploy that Satan has ever weaved in all of history. It's called lethargy. So we look at the front door and we wait for him and come on, Satan, you know, we're going to fight you. You know, while he's coming in the back door. And we're just, he's going to lull us into false security, hunger and thirst after material and earthly comforts and possessions. It'll keep you just busy enough that you never have time to do anything for God. And he likes to keep you really close to the line. He never pushes you way over that till you go, I gotta get rid of some of this stuff. I gotta stop doing this. I ain't doing anything. That just usually doesn't happen. Usually he just keeps you close that you keep thinking, I'll get it under control. Just all I need is, you know, is this thermos, you know, and this lamp. That's for those of you that know what I'm talking about. So, you know, you think, well, this is all I need, you know, this I get it. I'm close. Just, you know, another 6 months and I'll get it under control and then I'll be able to serve God. And he's just giggling at you. He's just keeping you, just toying, you know. He even cuts you a little space there. And you go, I made a work day at church. Yay! You know, and you go, oh, there, I'm okay. And then we don't see you again for 6 months. He's messing with you. He's messing with you. Do what you need to do. Time is a ticking. I don't know about you, but I want to leave my mark. Maybe that's a male thing, a macho thing, you know? I don't know. I when I'm gone, you know, I want the devil to be relieved. Oh, thank God. Well, not thank God, but at least he's gone. And I hope he's that way that you guys do that, all of us, that we all leave him in fear. Okay? Let's all stand.